So yes, as I was saying in the first half, I want to continue talking about a theme that Subhadramati and I have been talking about for the last 2 weeks, and then we're going to continue exploring. And the theme is, you can sort of read more about it in this booklet, which is on sale on the desk outside. It's called The Greater Mandala. Actually, there's two themes in this booklet. So one is The Greater Mandala, which I was talking about in the first half, this notion that we could experience a sort of awareness where we are able to just sort of rest in appreciative awareness all the time, as well as, of course, going about our sort of useful activities that we have to do, live life as we have to do it, but always in this mode of, well, metta, of appreciation, of a sense of relaxed ease. So in a way, there's an emphasis here on counteracting our drivenness, our goal-orientedness, and also counteracting a tendency that can arise amongst us Buddhist practitioners to also be driven in our Buddhist practice. That can also happen, this sort of striving in a rather forced way towards Buddhahood. Anyway, this is a teaching which tries to counteract that. But then there's another teaching in this booklet, lovely little booklet, by the way. And this teaching, the second teaching, is called The Bitendential Value of Being, which, as far as I'm aware, doesn't make sense. If it makes sense to you, tell me afterwards. But I never know what the bitendential value of being means. It's a really rather complicated expression for something fairly simple, nonetheless profound. And this teaching, the second teaching, the bitendential value of being teaching, says that that we can't really make progress on the path to enlightenment if we're just concerned with ourselves alone. That working for the good of others, our ethical life, which flowers in an enlightened being, it flowers as enlightened compassion, that altruistic, outward-going emphasis is as needed, as necessary to spiritual progress, to dharmic progress, as the inward-going, more still, more meditative cultivation of higher mental states. That the two go hand in hand. They can't be divorced from each other. And if they are divorced from each other, you're not really practicing Buddhism. You're not really practicing the Dharma. And when enlightenment dawns, when Buddhahood dawns, the two, as it were, polarities of self and other, inward and outward, are transcended in a new type of consciousness that doesn't see the two as distinct. Yeah? Self and other, me and you, inward and outward, mine and yours, don't make any sense, in a new consciousness where dualisms of any kind are seen as, well, relative at best, illusory, really. Sort of constructed in the unenlightened mind. Anyway, so this book talks about, on the one hand, the greater mandala, and on the other hand, the bitangential value of being, the need to include altruism, ethics, concern for others, concern for the world around us in our practice of the Dharma. Earlier today, I was being interviewed by the BBC for a programme which I've never watched called Sunday Morning Live. Has anybody heard of Sunday Morning Live? No. Oh, well, there you go. A million people watch it, but nobody in this room. Well, watch it, because I'm going to be on it. And I don't know when, actually. It might not be on Sunday. And, of course, it's not live, is it? Because I was just being interviewed. So there's a bit of a misnomer, because it's Monday afternoon that I was being interviewed for it. Anyway, they came here. And it was very interesting, because what they were asking me, they were talking about secular mindfulness, the rise of secular mindfulness. In particular, they'd been in earlier in the day, they'd been meeting with Andy Puddicombe, who's the founder of Headspace. Yeah. And so Headspace is you'll probably have heard of Headspace, haven't you? Have you heard of Headspace? Yeah, everybody's heard of Headspace. Headspace is this mindfulness, it's a meditation app. Yeah, it's an app. A very, very successful product. And many people are introduced to meditation, I think, these days through apps like Headspace, maybe Headspace itself. Yeah. And they were saying to me, what do you think as a Buddhist of secular apps like Headspace in particular, what do you think? And they were trying to say, what were they weren't, I mean, they did me a little, they sort of, as they were setting up, they were briefing me and saying, you know, this is the sort of thing we're going to ask. And then they were saying, if you want to, you could say, if you want to, you could say that, you know, secular meditation is sort of just a sham, you know. They didn't say that word. They didn't, but that's what they were sort of, you know, because it's lacking in ethics, isn't it? It's lacking in ethics. Or only if you want to say that, though. Only if you want to say that. they wanted a story. You know, they wanted a... Anyway, I think I managed to acquit myself in a way that did justice to the fact that secular mindfulness, secular meditation, doesn't have the scope and the range and the depth that's possible through Buddhist practice. It's limited. Yeah, it's limited. At the same time, it's not a bad thing. For many people, it's their way into meditation. And for some of those many people, and meditation alone is not a bad thing, it's a good thing. If more people meditated, secular or Buddhist, that would be great. But for some people, it's also a doorway into the Dharma. You know, and then that's just fantastic. Anyway, so I don't think I gave them quite the polarized line that they were looking for. But in a way, I could have done. If I wanted to, I could have said, what's missing from the secular kind of model of meditation is this teaching of the bitendential value of being. That's what's missing. That wouldn't have made much sense. And I don't want to just be nonsensical on television. So, but what's missing in this sort of secular approach, often, and I'm generalising, and forgive me if this is, you know, either not your experience or, you know, it won't be everybody's experience, but what's often missing is that meditation is seen as a way of improving one's own life, my life. So I want to be more free of stress. I want to be generally healthier. I want to be free of low moods. I might be battling a recurrent of depression, or I want to recover from addiction, or I want to manage physical pain better in my, you know, in my life, chronic pain, or all sorts of reasons. But you can understand they're all sort of worthy reasons, aren't they? And one wouldn't want to criticize any of the reasons per se. And yet, what one has to say is that Buddhism isn't really about just adjusting better to this life. Yeah? It includes that, but it isn't just about that. And if we set our horizons at just making this life better for me, if that's the limit of our ambition, then it isn't really Buddhism. Yeah? It's not bad. It'd be great if everybody was stress-free, free of pain, free of depression, free of addiction, and other mental pain that meditation can address. But it's not Buddhism. It's not Buddhism unless there's, well, three things actually. What I said to the interviewer this afternoon was that you need an ethical foundation that's explicit. Yeah, an ethical foundation that's based in kindness. The precepts that we just chanted in the first half, you look at them, they're kindness, cultivation of generosity, cultivation of contentment, cultivation of truthfulness. And then, yes, the fifth one is cultivation of mindfulness. Yeah? So all of those are necessary. One can argue, this is just the first thing, I've got two more, but just around the ethics thing, one can argue that if you go deep enough into mindfulness, into awareness, that the others will emerge. Yeah? If your mindfulness is strong enough, kindness will emerge. And there's truth in that. There's truth in that. Unfortunately, for most people, it doesn't happen that way. Yeah? It doesn't happen that way for most people. For some people, maybe they're already naturally kind. Yeah? So cultivation of mindfulness just helps that. Maybe their ethical values are already aligned with the teaching of the Buddha. Many people are like that without knowing that they're aligned with Buddhism. They just naturally are. So then when they learn mindfulness or meditation, you know, that's great. It takes off. Their ethical life provides a foundation for practice. But in and of itself, I'm not sure that meditation, secular mindfulness meditation, for most people, will change their ethical values for the better. Yeah. That's a moot point, and I speak personally. You know, I'm speaking for myself. I'm not saying that's everybody's position. The second thing, though, that is missing, I think, from a secular perspective, is that there isn't a transcendent ideal. So I was just talking about enlightenment as transcending this polarity of self and other, of me and you. That's a transcendent ideal, yeah? Where we really see that the separateness that we ordinarily experience is illusory if we go deep enough into consciousness, into awareness. This separateness is relative, but not ultimately true. Just as, I don't know, you could pick this up and you can say it's solid. And yes, at one level it's solid, but if you go deep enough into an analysis of what it's made of, you find it's mainly empty space. And it's not obvious to our ordinary eyes and our ordinary sense of touch that this is mostly empty space. And yet, that truth is a deeper truth. Yeah? It's a deeper truth. And this sense of solidity, from that deeper perspective, is illusory and contingent, and it's a relative reality. So similarly, this separation between me and you, and you and the next person, is a sort of relative truth. Of course, at one level, yes, that's how we experience the world. We experience our bodies and our minds as separate, our lives as distinct. So that's not completely untrue, just as this thing isn't completely, I couldn't say that it wasn't solid. Yeah, it's just that there's a deeper reality, and that deeper reality isn't apprehensible to the senses. It's not these physical senses that are going to apprehend that deeper truth. It's going to be another dimension of consciousness that apprehends that. And that other dimension of consciousness isn't in this relative world of me and you. It's already in a transcendent realm, for want of a better word. Even the realm, actually no word does it justice, because this transcendent dimension of consciousness transcends also not just subject and object and me and you, but it transcends time and space. Time and space itself are seen as relative, as relatively real. So this transcendent dimension is missing in a secular app. Yeah, mostly. So that was the second thing. And the third thing that I wanted to talk about what I did talk about, was in a way the sense of community, and this brings me back to this altruistic dimension, the sense of community, the sense of sangha that is so intrinsic to Dharma life. Sangha isn't just a support group, although it can act as one. Sangha is an ideal. It's an ideal that sees everybody living in a different way, a fellowship of human beings existing, relating to each other through love, yeah, and friendship and solidarity and empathy and compassion and delight, rather than this world that we inhabit where so often relationships are based on power and competitiveness and hatred and animosity and suspicion and greed and you know what I mean. So community, sangha, a vision of a society based on transcendent ideals is intrinsic to a Buddhist life, and you won't find it in a secular app. Yeah. So those were the three things that I was talking about as missing from secular mindfulness. You could also say that the bitendential value of being is another way of talking about all of those. Yeah, it's another way of talking about ethics. Ethics as an altruistic activity, not just working on metta in our minds, but living from metta. That's the Dharma life. The bitendential value of being also emphasizes this transcendent ideal, because it's saying that reality itself transcends this bitendential, which means two tendencies. It transcends the tendencies towards inner and outer, subject and object, self and other. Yeah. Being presents us in that split way, but there's a deeper truth or higher truth that transcends that. And then the bitendential value of being also talks about how it's no good me trying to aim for enlightenment for myself if what the transcendent goal is a realization of the non-separateness of me and you and me and all beings and you and all beings. Then aiming for that just for me, it's contradictory. You have to work on trying to improve the lives of others. The lives of others is actually working on trying to improve, alleviate suffering in the world is perhaps a more effective way of moving towards enlightenment than just working on our own minds in the comfort of our own headspace. Yeah. So anyway, that was what I was trying to get at this afternoon. Watch Sunday. I don't know when it's going to be on, actually. It will be on a Sunday. And they'll have probably edited me, and I might have come over all bumbling anyway. Anyway, if you do watch it, be nice about it. Yeah, I'm not used to being on television. So that's sort of a preamble to what I wanted to talk about, which is what do we do about world problems? How as Buddhists do we even think about, let alone try and relate to or do something about problems in the world problems, problems that affect not just, I'm thinking not just of one culture and society, but worldwide issues, problems in a way that affect all of us. So what sort of problems do you think I'm thinking about? What would you class as, let's see if we can come up with at least five, there's more, I'm sure, world problems. So at least we know what sort of terrain we're trying to address. What do you think?
Poverty.
Who said poverty? Yes, poverty. Yeah, so poverty, in some ways extreme poverty. So food and water, lack of food and water, that sort of poverty, lack of shelter, lack of, and then you could go on. You could talk about lack of health care, and then you could go on and say lack of education. But appallingly, even in this 2019, there are millions of people suffering from lack of food and water and shelter.
Yeah.
Adequate food and water and shelter. So that's a world problem that we should be concerned about. It's sort of somehow we've got something very wrong. The systems seem very wrong. Something's gone very wrong. If we live in a world where, well, I can have a smoothie and an omelette and a pan au chocolat and a nice flat white for breakfast, brunch, actually I did this morning. Do you know what I mean? That does feel obscene in a certain sense, yeah? Okay, poverty, yeah, what else?
Climate change,
yeah. So climate change very much on the agenda at the moment. Thankfully, is on the agenda at the moment, but there you go, climate change. I won't say more about that. We know the issues, at least. Yeah.
Lack of meaning and self-understanding.
So this, I think, is one that I didn't expect to come up, but I think it's very. Let me just. Yeah, lack of meaning and self-understanding is something that's endemic and really lacking in our very wealthy materialist Western cultures. We may not be immediately suffering from the hunger and the poverty, although some people do, I know. We may not immediately be feeling the effects of global warming, although some people might be, if they're living in the wrong place, as it were. But our culture is full of people suffering from a lack of meaning. What are we doing with our lives? And I gave a talk at the centre, and I was talking about Viktor Frankl. Do you remember Viktor Frankl? Viktor Frankl was a survivor of the Holocaust. He spent time as a prisoner of Auschwitz and possibly some other concentration camps. I can't quite remember. Anyway, he lived, he survived, he became a psychologist, and he wrote a number of things, but one of his most famous books is Man's Search for Meaning. And his premise was, it was lack of meaning that was causing so much pain and suffering. And he talks about how you can find your humanity, it's humanity that gives us meaning. You can find it in the most appalling situations. He said, this is from Man's Search for Meaning, I think, "We who lived in concentration camps can remember the men who walked through the huts comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way." And I think he was sort of saying that those that didn't lose their humanity in the most inhumane conditions were the people that perhaps had the best chance of surviving. And if they did survive, they had something to live for. Yeah, because those conditions could strip you of not just your life, but all meaning. Yeah, the meaning of being human. So yeah, lack of meaning. So we've had poverty, we've had climate change, we've had lack of meaning. What else?
Violence,
yeah, war.
Do you want to say anything to elaborate on that, or is it obvious? It's obvious. Okay, so violence at the sort of personal, local level, the stabbings that we're seeing happening most weeks in this country, somewhere along the line, somewhere, you know, it was in Manchester recently, wasn't it? Violence in all sorts of individual situations, domestic or otherwise, horrible though that is, even that pales into, by comparison, to the wars, to the sort of what violence on a national scale that's happening. So, you know, Turkey going into Syria just recently, those Kurdish people being bombed, that's awful in itself, I think. Well, it is, isn't it? I mean, that's unarguably awful. And if history has anything to teach us, that's going to escalate. Yeah, that won't stay just amongst the Kurds and the Turkish people. That's going to escalate. Yeah, and we've got violence in terms of, well, unfortunately, even Buddhist countries, as Myanmar demonstrated recently, horribly, shamefully, the violence against the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar was, for Buddhism, one of the bleakest, blackest events of recent times. Unfortunately, not the only example where Buddhists, so-called professed Buddhists, have acted violently, but the most notable recent one, perhaps. And that won't go away. Those people who have now had are refugees, you know, that's not going to be forgotten. Yeah, so violence on a national, international kind of level. Nationalism, the whole rise of nationalism fuels this sort of violence. By nationalism, I don't mean patriotism. I don't mean just being proud of, I don't know, your country and your culture, and which is fine. I think it is fine to be proud of one's heritage. What I mean by nationalism is a sort of fanatical protection of one's own nation at the expense of others, and then opposition in regard to them. I could probably find a better definition, but I think you know what I mean by nationalism. You look at that, and it's on the rise, not just in America, not just in China, you know, all the violence that's happening in Hong Kong, or at least the demonstration, not just in China, but even in Europe. Yeah. The rise of fascism, or certainly frighteningly far-right-ism, in Hungary, for example, and it's not just Hungary, it's growing in other European countries. That's frightening. Yeah. Any other kind of horrible things that come to mind, and then we'll try and move on to... Species extinction. So species extinction, particularly associated maybe with climate change and the sort of mass level of species. Of course, species extinction on a smaller level happens all the time and has happened since species existed. But on this mass level, it's a new thing. And you were saying?
Greed.
Yeah, so greed goes back to, in a way, a fundamental part of the unenlightened mind. So from a Dharmic perspective, all human-made problems, and I know not everything is human-made, but all human-made problems come from our basic greed and our hatred and our delusion. Yeah. So you could say something like greed underlies our existential situation as unenlightened beings, and then of course it manifests at different levels, and results in things like poverty, things, for some, things like climate change, all sorts of things, war. You know, it can underlie all sorts of other manifestations of suffering.
I meant money greed,
money greed, greed for materialist, for possessions. The same urge is there for grasping, whether it exists in me wanting my, what was it this morning? Pain au chocolat and flat white, which is a relatively innocent way of grasping. But the same urge can happen on a global level. And cause all sorts of problems. So look, we've just looked at a range of issues. Now, the first thing I want to say is that Buddhism doesn't have any single answer to any issue. As Buddhists, we won't necessarily all even agree on the importance of the issue, let alone a solution. Yeah. So I know some Buddhists who I class as friends who aren't very concerned about climate change and don't think that, you know, is the crisis an emergency that some people do. And then I know other Buddhists who have been, and who I class as friends, who have been, supporting Extinction Rebellion, camping out in the rain, or all sorts of things. And what I'm trying to illustrate there is not just that there's a incongruity. I'm saying that Buddhism doesn't give you particular solutions to particular issues. Yeah, it won't say this is what you need to do, or this is what we all have to agree on. So when you meet a Buddhist who disagrees with your social or political views, that's all right. In fact, tolerance is one of the real virtues of Buddhism, tolerance of people with different views. And in the Sangha that we're part of in Tri Ratna, you do have people across the whole political spectrum. And I'm delighted about that. I'm delighted to meet people whose views challenge mine and who force me to think. And in fact, I think as Buddhists, if you're serious about Buddhism, I'm not completely sure that we should just be identified in simplistic terms as left or right. You know, that just feels too unnuanced for a really intelligent response. Today is the 63rd anniversary of the mass conversion in India to Buddhism, led by Dr. Ambedkar. Dr. Ambedkar was, he's a hero. He's a great, great statesman of the 20th century. And he's a hero of Buddhism. The people who have converted under his leadership and guidance regard him as a bodhisattva. He was born into a Hindu Hinduism as an untouchable, as part of the lowest of the low in the caste system, the Dalit community. Yeah. And he managed to, Dr. Ambedkar, through the sponsorship of some generous patrons, to get a decent education when normally, people from his community wouldn't have even had any education. You know, there's still incredible oppression of people at the bottom of the caste system. They're outside the caste system, actually. So in rural India, they're still seen as untouchable. Yeah, they're very touch. Sometimes they're very sight. Is said to pollute a caste Hindu. They're not allowed to drink from the same well or draw water from the same well as caste Hindus. They're not allowed to have the same rights of education or employment or whatever. Now, untouchability was banned in India, so legally it's not part of the system, but unfortunately it persists because it's an intrinsic part of Hinduism. And talking of nationalism, Hindu nationalism is on the rise in India. And for the Buddhists in India, in fact, for any minority religion in India, that's really bad news. Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, they're suffering in India under the rise of Hindu nationalism. Yeah, that's something that's happening now, this horrible prejudice. But anyway, Dr. Ambedkar was born into that community. And through, he was a brilliant, brilliant man, and through receiving an education that was, well, second to none, he was educated at the LSE and in the States. He then went back to India, and he could have just been a very successful lawyer. He could have made a very, very successful, comfortable living for himself. And you could have forgiven him that, having risen out of the direst poverty and oppression, to go back and, you know, just have a decent life. He could have done that. He didn't. he joined Nehru's government. Nehru was the first prime minister of an independent India. He joined Nehru's government as the law minister, and he helped write, in fact, he pretty much single-handedly did write the Indian constitution. Anyway, he was determined as a statesman to try and relieve the suffering of millions of Indians from his community. In the end, he realized that he couldn't do that while still being a Hindu. And he realized that Hinduism was part of the oppressive system. And there was no way out of that for him. He tried, and he came to loggerheads with Gandhi, for example, who wanted him to stay a Hindu and work within the Hindu framework. Anyway, Dr. Ambedkar decided that there had to be a way out of the Hindu oppressive system, the oppression of Hinduism. And having studied other religions and looked at them, he decided that Buddhism was the way out. And Buddhism was, after all, born in India. Yeah, it was an Indian teaching, although it died out in India in the 12th century. And he converted to Buddhism. And when he converted, how many hundreds of thousands? Do you know how many hundreds of thousands?
About 600,000.
600,000 people on that day, on the 14th of October, 63 years ago, converted after him. They took the refuges and precepts from him. He took the refuges and precepts from a Buddhist monk, and then he administered the refuges and precepts to 600,000 people in one day, just one day. And Buddhism suddenly became a revival of Buddhism started in India. Unfortunately, he died 6 weeks hence, 6 weeks from that conversion ceremony. And Buddhism could have been lost because most of the people that converted had converted for social reasons. They wanted a way out of the indignity of Hindu oppression. And Buddhism promised them that, but they didn't know what Buddhism really was. And he died. And they were left stranded in no man's land. And well, anyway, there's a whole story there, and I'm not going to go into it, but Sangharakshita, the founder of Triratna, played a critical role at the time of Dr. Ambedkar's death in giving hope to the newly converted Buddhists. And in the words of some of them, he saved Buddhism for India, for those people. I had a very moving experience of this. When I was ordained 20 years ago, and I was ordained in India, and so I went, I flew into Nagpur, and Nagpur is the heart of Buddhist India. That's where Dr. Ambedkar did the conversion ceremony. And I flew into Mumbai and then went to Nagpur,
And the first night I was there, I was put up in a, I stayed in a hotel, and it was, you know, for Indian standards, it was a nice-ish hotel. And the morning, there was a woman who was a chambermaid, I guess, cleaning my room, and she was an Indian woman, and I couldn't speak any Hindi or Marathi, and she had no English. So we just exchanged smiles and, you know, sort of non-verbal greetings as she was sort of cleaning my room. And suddenly she saw on my bedside table a book, and it was a book which was a memoir of Sangharakshita's, and it had a photo of Sangharakshita on the cover. It was called In the Sign of the Golden Wheel, a memoir of some of his time in India. And she looked at that and she said, oh, Bante. And Bante is the word, the affectionate word that we give to Sangharakshita. It means revered teacher. And we had a teacher in common. Suddenly I'd flown to India. I thought I had no language, no shared language with this woman. And suddenly we were part of the same Sangha. Isn't that incredible? Such a moving moment for me. I felt uplifted, but also joyous that Buddhism wasn't limited to the culture that I was familiar with, and that Sangharakshita, the movement that I was part of, was truly an international one. And that for the Indians who have converted to Buddhism, it was a peaceful social revolution. That's what they've been part of. Now here, Buddhism tends towards a psychotherapeutic technique of secular mindfulness. Do you see what I mean? Whereas in India, it's a social revolution. They're overturning, challenging, confronting prejudice at the deepest possible level. So I think that we've got to find a way of making our Buddhism social. Yeah, doing something. It's not so easy in the West. It's not so straightforward and clear-cut. And there won't be, as I say, one solution that everybody kind of agrees on. So what do we do? So I think there are some principles that maybe we can draw out and see if you can think of others. So one kind of principle is that we have to take this teaching of the bitendential value of being seriously. So we have to be working on our own minds, and we have to be working on making a contribution in the world. Yeah, the both. One without the other, and it's not Buddhism. One without the other, and it doesn't lead to enlightenment, to Buddhahood. So let's take working on our own minds first. So if we're not working on our own minds, if we're not trying to cultivate positivity, kindness, mindfulness, generosity of spirit, open-heartedness, a sense of solidarity with all life, if we're not trying to do that, and then we're sitting on an Extinction Rebellion, you know, protest, then somehow there's something missing. Because what can easily happen if activism isn't mirrored or matched by internal working on one's own mind is that you can get into negative mental states. Does that make sense? One can easily give rise to and give in to anger, frustration. What else? What else? What are the negative mental states that can arise from a good, well-intended activist approach? What else? Who said arrogance? Violence, hopelessness, despondency, despair, particularly when you're faced with huge issues like climate change, or, you know, or even perhaps less global issues, but intractable ones like, what are we going to do about the war in Syria? One can start to easily fall into despondency, hopelessness, frustration. Blame. Blame's another one.
we can easily start to say, look, it would be fine if it wasn't for this group of people. Yeah? Be it the bankers or be it the whatever. Yeah? The Turkish government in this case. We can start to blame, and what that does is it divides our mind, taking us away from this ideal of transcendence where actually we transcend the duality between self and other. Yeah? So we have to be working on our minds. We have to, as Buddhists, be working on our minds. We have to be taking responsibility for our mental states. This is what Viktor Frankl says is our only freedom. It's the freedom that can never be taken away. Let me read you another bit of Viktor Frankl. When we are no longer able to change a situation, we are challenged to change ourselves. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. Isn't that brilliant? Let me read it again. When we are no longer able to change a situation, which he wasn't able to do in Auschwitz, when we are no longer able to change a situation, we are challenged to change ourselves. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. That space arises when you cultivate mindfulness and metta. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. So this is he could have been talking about the Dharma. It is pure Dharma. It's saying that there is a space between stimulus and response, and in that lies our freedom and our growth. And normally, if we're just acting out of unawareness, if we're reacting, then it feels like there's no space. We have a stimulus and we immediately respond, out of greed or hatred. In that space, if we can cultivate, we can grow that space through practice. And then we could find a way of responding that is creative. We find a way of loving when there's no reason to love. We find a way of being generous people were in a concentration camp giving away their bit of bread. That is an incredible act of heroism that I don't know if I could do. Yeah, I mean, it should shake us, this capacity for heroism in some people. That happens when you create a space and refuse to just react according to gut instinct or animal instinct. We find a deeper humanity and we respond from that. So we have to be working on our minds, because that is our only freedom in the end. If the going gets really tough, all we'll have is the freedom to choose our response. Yeah? Okay, so that's working on our minds. But if we're just working on our minds, and this is how I started off our talk, it's very easy for Buddhism, meditation, all the teachings of Buddhism, just to become a way of becoming more self-centered. In a nicer, refined way. You know, so we might use, I don't know, we might not use plastic straws, and we might be really good at recycling and composting and all the rest of it. But we could still be living in a thoroughly self-centered materialist way, fundamentally concerned with either with number one or number one, two, three, four, five, our immediate family. Yeah? That atomization of society, which is all around us, this individualism, can be, if we're not careful, supported by and enhanced by Buddhism, taken wrongly. Yeah? Because Buddhism will give you more peace of mind. It will make you generally more content, happier with your life, less stressed, more able to enjoy beauty and art and culture. Get on better with colleagues and friends. And if we're not careful, all of those benefits are used just to enhance me and mine. So we have to be doing something, if it's really Buddhist, if it's really Buddhism, we have to be taking seriously suffering in the world around us and saying, what are we going to do? Now, I think one way of doing that, that's an intelligent way of doing that, I don't even know if it's intelligent, actually. I don't really know what the answers are. But what I think one needs to do is prioritise. So I can't address, and neither can probably any of us, everything in the world. Yeah, it's too overwhelming. And if you spread yourself too thin, you become ineffective in every area and probably succumb to overwhelm and despondency. So I think we have to prioritise. You have to say, how am I going to make a contribution to making the world a better place? And each of us will be able to do that in a different way. Yeah? And it might be through the work that you already do. Your work might be already making a contribution to helping the lives of other people. And plenty of people in the Sangha do that sort of work. Yeah? Or it might be that you find another way. What I think we need to do is find a cause that's bigger than ourselves in order to take us out of this intrinsic tendency to just look after myself. So climate change, if that's the thing that you feel most passionate about, then find a way of contributing and do it in a non-violent way. It has to be non-violent. If it's Buddhist, it has to be non-violent. Do it in a way that isn't blaming. Yeah? Do it in a way that is trying to make connection, not break connection with people. Do it in a way that doesn't lead to anger, frustration, despondency, despair, hopelessness. Do it in a way that is creative, positive, that celebrates the beauty of life. Yeah, we should be concerned about species extinction, not just because species extinction is going to mean that human beings might find it much more problematic to have food or medicine or whatever it is to live our comfortable lives. We should also be concerned about species extinction because this is life and it's beautiful. Life, we share something with all life. In a way, I don't think it should even just be about species extinction. Every life that suffers and dies is important, whether it's the last of that species or not. So, for example, looking at your diet, how do you live and eat so that you're not making such an impact? Can we move towards more and more vegetarianism, or in my case, veganism? Can we live more kindly? Yeah, that has a... I know it's not enough, but at least we can be doing what we can. So choose something, a cause, that works for you in your life, and then do everything that you can within your life to further that cause. That might mean pressurizing governments. That might be spreading, information about that cause. And that might mean direct action in some non-violent way. Whatever it is, engage. Engage. Now, I want to come on to one more thing, though, which is that the way that I've chosen is primarily to help teach the Dharma. Because if people practice, if they learn the Dharma, if they learn the metta bhavana, if they learn about Buddhist ethics, if they learn about the bi-tendential value of being, and they really apply it, then there's a transformation happening in the individual and in their sphere of influence, in whatever connections that individual has. And in the end, I think the issues that we're facing in the world are only going to be really solved by a raising of consciousness. if we can't overcome our greed and our hatred and our delusion, then as a species, we're not going to overcome the problems that we're talking about. Yeah? In the end, that's the fundamental issue. Our unenlightenedness, our deludedness, our illusion of separateness. So that too is a form of activism. Being a Buddhist and spreading the Dharma is working at that deepest level. The trouble with working at the deepest level is that you have to do it one by one. Yeah? I can't convince you to meditate, and you can't convince anybody else to meditate. We can't make them meditate, let's say. Yeah? We each have to work on transforming our own consciousness. But what we can do is encourage and exemplify and support and create community that offers, I think, a tiny beacon of hope in this atomized world. And it offers, for many people, meaning where there is no meaning. And unless we work on this level, then even if we were to, by some beautiful miracle, sort out the problems of climate change and war and poverty and all the other things that we've talked about, even if we were to do that, by some wonderful, beautiful, miraculous coming together, if we haven't elevated our consciousness, then the problem, the existential issue of what do we do with our lives won't have gone away. Yeah? Because all of us face death in one way or another. So here we are, we're mortal, death hasn't gone away. What are we going to do with our lives? What is it to be really human? So even if we solve the external world problems, we're still left with that conundrum, that existential question mark. My belief is that Buddhism addresses that par excellence. Yeah, it addresses that question of who we are, what it is to be human, and what is our human potential par excellence. So sometimes people talk about engaged Buddhism. I don't like that term because it makes it seem like there's a disengaged Buddhism that's possible. Yeah? And I think if it's Buddhism, and if we're really addressing the bi-tendential value of being, then it's always engaged. It's always engaged. Yeah? It's always engaged. And the Buddhist movement that this centre's part of is a movement that's trying to engage with as many people as possible in the world, trying to get them to all see their own potential and grow into that potential as human beings, and then trying to, also trying to create community. And then as a community, seeing if we can be more and more a force for good in the world, however you choose to do that. And as I say, for me, that's primarily about spreading the Dharma or trying to spread the Dharma, trying to teach the, in a way, that the most lofty, noble teaching that I think human beings have ever been exposed to. This teaching of it's represented on the shrine here in all of these figures, and I'm not going to be able to, I haven't got time now to go into them, into the figures themselves, but the images here on this shrine are each of them in their different ways representing the potential of the human heart and mind, our potential, and saying that it is possible in this lifetime to transcend all limitations of self-centered consciousness, to transcend this notion that I exist as a separate, fixed entity in this world, to release, in doing that, to release a force in consciousness of love that is unconditional and without any boundaries, and then to act from that love in a way that is creative all the time, all the time. That, to me, is the most noble, lofty aspiration that I can, well, I've ever come across. And if that speaks to you, then I'd urge you to move towards it. Yeah, move towards that ideal. And even if none of us ever get there, you know, I'm never going to become golden and well, neither are you. You know, even if we don't ever get to the ideal that Buddhism points, doesn't matter. Ideals are so that we can orientate our lives and strive for something more than we're currently living for. So it's an orientation, and it's that orientation that I think this world needs more than anything else. Of course it needs more food and water. Of course it needs solutions to climate change and to nationalism and to religious fundamentalism and factionalism and war and hatred and all sorts of things. But fundamentally, underlying that is a need for a transformation of consciousness. Yeah? And we need to be working towards that. And you do that by working on yourself, but by also working on alleviating suffering wherever you find it in the world. If you do the both, then you can touch at times moments where the boundary between self and other thins. And if you do that, I think that we're capable of achieving extraordinary things. And I think that that's where hope really lies for the world. So I'll leave you there. Thank you. Yeah.